talking, one of the students, Eric, met a fear he couldn't avoid. He told me that during a meditation the day before, he'd had a life-changing experience. It started with a lot of agitation and anxiety he was feeling about his mother and his wife, Julie. His mother recently had a stroke and might never again be able to walk or talk. Julie was struggling with chronic depression. Eric felt powerless to help, and powerless before the rising tide of anxiety that threatened to overtake him. Remembering the teaching I had given the night before about relating to fear, Eric decided to inquire into what he was feeling. Remaining aware of the sensations of anxiety in his body, he asked himself, "What is really asking for attention?" Suddenly, a traumatic scene from his childhood arose in his mind. Eric was about 6 years old, and he and his baby brother were playing on a dock at the lake by their summer house. His brother went too near the edge and fell off into the water. Eric screamed for help, not knowing what to do. But help came too late. All his life, Eric had always believed that his brother drowned because he hadn't been able to save him. Now, in meditation, all those feelings were rising to the surface, and Eric felt as if he would explode. His mind was racing a million miles an hour. He thought about his guilt, his fears about his wife, how things could get worse. He urgently wanted to do something but didn't know what. Suddenly, Eric's body went numb. The numbness was familiar. Eric frequently found himself feeling distant and detached when Julie would tell him how she had nothing to look forward to, nothing to give her any hope. He cared, but as he put it, "I wasn't able to be in the trenches with her. I couldn't really relate." At those times, when his body felt lifeless and his heart hard, his mind would struggle to come up with how to make things better. Now, during the sitting, Eric knew that beneath this numbness was a huge well of pain. If he went near it, he feared he would drown. But Eric had asked what wanted attention, and this was his answer. He was ready to meet the fear he had been pushing away for so long. Leaning into fear does not mean losing our balance and getting lost in fear. Because our usual stance in relating to fear is leaning away from it, to turn and face fear directly serves as a correction. As we lean in, we are inviting, moving toward what we habitually resist. Leaning in allows us to touch directly the quivering, the shakiness, the gripping tightness that is fear. Whether it is a familiar but vague feeling of anxiety or a strong surge of fear, leaning in can help us become aware and free in the midst of our experience. We might wake up after a disturbing dream. We might have just gotten a call from our doctor's office about a suspicious mammogram. We might hear a rumor of our company downsizing. We might have read a new warning about a potential terrorist attack. In any of these circumstances, a good way to begin the process is to pause and ask ourselves, "What is happening right now?" Like Eric, we can ask, "What is asking for attention?" Or, "What is asking for acceptance?" It is especially important to address this inquiry to the sensations we feel in our throat, heart, and stomach. These are the areas in our body where fear expresses itself most distinctly. When we begin to face fear by focusing on sensations, what often happens is our mind immediately produces a story. We might get lost in our plans on how to respond to a frightening situation. Or we might fixate on fearful beliefs and assumptions. "I'm afraid I'm a failure." "I'm afraid I'll never find love and intimacy." Or, "I'm afraid so-and-so will see how stupid and uninteresting I am and push me away." We might remember a recent conversation where our insecurity seemed obvious and embarrassing. Or we might, as Eric experienced, plunge into a past memory in which we came face to face with a feeling of powerlessness. The key to awakening from the bonds of fear is to move from our mental stories into immediate contact with the sensations of fear. The squeezing, pressing, burning, trembling, quaking, jittering life in our body. In fact, the story, as long as we remain awake and don't get stuck in it, can become a useful gateway to the raw fear itself. While the mind will continue to generate stories about what we fear, we can recognize the thoughts for what they are and drop under them again and again to connect with the feelings in our body. The stories that fed Eric's anxiety and powerlessness had led him to the deeper level of fear he had been trying to numb out all these years. Now, he opened to the fear and asked, "How big are you?" Instantly, his feelings of apprehension intensified, and the swelling pressure of fear exploded through his chest. His terror felt as if it could fill the entire meditation hall. Rather than pulling back, Eric silently said, "Yes." His heart was pounding loudly, and in his stomach he felt cramping and a strong feeling of nausea. An excruciating tension was building in his chest, as if a wall of muscle were trying to push the fear back, trying to surround and contain it. He again asked the question, "How big are you?" As if released by his question, the feeling of terror broke all bounds. It could fill the universe. Like the utter horror that seizes us if our child runs out into a busy street, the urgency of fear strangling Eric felt as if it would never subside, never be released. "If I open to this," Eric thought, "I'll be annihilated. This fear will kill me." Eric was saying yes and yet fighting at the same time. And the battle itself was compounding the intensity. Fear was ripping through his heart. In an instant, he realized the fear would kill him if he didn't allow it to exist in its fullness. Something deep inside him knew he had to let go. As Eric put it, "I finally just wanted to surrender into something bigger than fear. I wanted to give up trying to control what was going on in me." That basic longing finally won out, and Eric let go into the fear. It felt like my body and mind were breaking apart, that I was lost in a storm of burning winds, and my ashes were being dispersed in all directions. Leaning into fear can be as terrifying as Eric found it to be. Even when the process is not so intense, it's never comfortable. In fact, letting go into fear may feel, as Charlotte Jocko Beck puts it, like lying down on an icy couch. It can be extraordinarily difficult to let ourselves relax in that situation. We want to hold back because it feels as if we might die of the pain. Nevertheless, if we can let the hard edges of fear press into us, the sharpness stab us, the violence pull us apart, something amazing happens. Eric told me, when the chaos subsided, my mind was absolutely still. It was as if a screaming, thundering cacophony of sound had suddenly stopped, and I was resting in deep silence. It was vast and completely empty, yet it felt indescribably tender. As Eric experienced, when we are no longer trying to control fear and cling to life, our armor drops away, and we experience a deep and pure freedom. The other side of resisting fear is freedom. When we stop tensing against life, we open to an awareness that is immeasurably large and suffused with love. A few weeks later, Eric came to my weekly meditation group. He looked different. I noticed his shoulders weren't slumped. He was standing straight, and his chest seemed more open. He told me that he'd returned from the retreat to find his wife sunk into a bout of depression and hopelessness. He could feel the anxiety rising and automatically tensed. But rather than armoring against the fear and shutting down, Eric felt his heart open. "I was struck by how sad it makes me to see Julie miserable," he told me, "and how much she matters to me. so I just let her know that and held her, for a while. With a slightly embarrassed smile, he added, "You know, Tara, it's taken me a long time to realize that I can just hold her without trying to fix her." Rather than pulling away, Eric had discovered his capacity to remain accepting and kind in the face of anxiety. When the trance of fear arises, instead of getting caught up in worrying or looking for something to eat, instead of getting busy and trying to fix things, we can choose to lean in. Naturally, there are times when fear is too strong and we don't feel safe enough to engage with it. If we are feeling contracted and small, we may first need to widen the lens of awareness before bringing our full attention to fear. But in those moments when we can courageously lie down on the icy couch of fear and allow ourselves to experience its sharp edges, we are carried into the love and awareness that are beyond the reach of fear. The gift of fear. Barbara arrived at one of our final sessions, smiling brightly and eager to tell me something that had just happened. That morning, she had been meditating at home, and that terrifying memory had surfaced of being shoved underwater by her drunk father. As the fear began to swell, she remembered to pause and breathe deeply. She'd faced her fears many times over the past months, both in therapy and in meditation. She could handle this one now. As her throat tightened, she called on the fearless heart of the Buddha and imagined his compassionate presence holding the fear. When the childhood images threatened to carry her away, she came fully into the present, and listening to the sounds of the crickets and birds outside her window, felt as if the natural world was helping to hold the fear as well. When her mind felt spacious enough, she let herself lean into the sharp, clutching pain in her chest. By the end of the sitting, she actually felt the calm after a storm. She could still see the images, but they didn't seem to trigger the feelings in her body. The memory might come back, but somehow I don't think the pain of it is going to take me over again. Ever. Just as I was about to celebrate her breakthrough, Barbara went on. As I was driving over here, I passed by the church in my neighborhood. There's always a message up on the announcement board. Today it read, "What happens underwater? The Holy Spirit enters." We both sat quietly for a few moments, fully letting in the power of that message. Then Barbara continued, "You know, I can see now that my father was the first to baptize me. Strange as it seems, he was the one who set in motion my whole spiritual unfolding." I told her it didn't seem strange at all. "The pain of that experience and all the times he hurt you have been baptisms. They awoke in you a deep yearning for peace, for love, a yearning that's guided you powerfully on the spiritual path." She nodded slowly, her eyes soft and moist. "It's true. Maybe this longing is the voice of the Holy Spirit, and I'm finally learning to listen more carefully." Before Barbara left, I let her know how much I honored her devotion to spiritual practice. It takes courage to listen deeply, and that's what you've done. Instead of giving up on meditation or on life, you were willing to keep paying attention. As we sat quietly for a few moments, I realized what made me most happy for Barbara. "By facing fear," I told her, "you've opened to a love great enough to hold the fearful one inside you." When we come face to face with the fear and pain in our psyche, we stand at the gateway to tremendous renewal and freedom. Our deepest nature is awareness, and when we fully inhabit that, we love freely and are whole. This is the power of radical acceptance. When we stop fighting the energy that has been bound in fear, it naturally releases into the boundless sea of awareness. The more we awaken from the grip of fear, the more radiant and free becomes our heart. Several months after we ended therapy, I saw Barbara at a day-long meditation workshop I was teaching. During our lunch break, she came to show me something. It was a brochure from the dance place. Barbara had registered for a 10-week jazz series, and she and Randy had already started taking swing dancing classes together. The weekend before, she told me, they'd had a great time when they visited her parents. I knew Barbara had gotten closer to her father since he'd joined AA, and her mother was like a new person. Besides, Randy's presence there always made her feel safe. But this time, a real breakthrough had occurred. After the four finished dinner, Barbara went into the living room and put on a tape of music from their dance class. Accompanied by a loud and cheerful band, she and Randy gave a lively demonstration of the steps they had just been taught. Her parents clapped and then insisted on trying the moves themselves. At one point, her father had turned to her and said, "Barb, you used to dance when you were little. You were good. Why did you stop?" She smiled without answering. Inside, she felt a pang of sadness, the hurt of not having been known. But her old fears were no longer stopping her from dancing, and that filled her with the light of hope. "It's not only dancing, Tara," Barbara said. "It's everything. I feel like my life is in front of me, and I'm free to live it." Our ultimate refuge. As long as we are alive, we feel fear. It is an intrinsic part of our makeup, as natural as a bitter cold winter day or the winds that rip branches off trees. If we resist it or push it aside, we miss a powerful opportunity for awakening. Rilke writes, "Unites of anguish. Why didn't I kneel more deeply to accept you? Inconsolable sisters, and surrendering, lose myself in your loosened hair. How we squander our hours of pain. How we gaze beyond them into the bitter duration to see if they have an end. Though they are really seasons of us. Our winter. If we are waiting only for our fear to end, we will not discover the pure and loving presence that unfolds as we surrender into the darkest of nights. Only by letting go into the stream of life and loss and death do we come into this freedom. Facing fear is a lifelong training in letting go of all we cling to. It is a training in how to die. We practice as we face our many daily fears. Anxiety about performing well, insecurity around certain people, worries about our children, about our finances, about letting down people we love. Our capacity to meet the ongoing losses in life with radical acceptance grows with practice. In time, we find that we can indeed handle fear, including that deepest fear of losing life itself. Our willingness to face our fear frees us from trance, and bestows on us the blessings of awareness. We let go of deeper and subtler layers of resistance until there is nothing left to resist at all. There is only awake and open awareness. This is the refuge that has room for both living and dying. In this radiant and changeless awareness, we can, as Rilke puts it, contain death. The whole of death, can hold it in one's heart, gentle, and not refuse to go on living. Radical acceptance of fear carries us to this source of all freedom, to the ultimate refuge that is our true home. Guided meditation, meeting fear with an open and engaged presence. You will benefit from cultivating an open and engaged presence as described in this exercise during those times when you are not experiencing feelings and sensations linked to trauma. If your fear is related to trauma or feels overwhelming, the practice of being with fear may lead to emotional flooding and be inappropriate. In these cases, rather than facing fear on your own, it is important that you seek support from trusted friends, guidance from a meditation teacher, or skillful help from a therapist. Find a comfortable place to sit where the view is not distracting or confined. You might look out a window, or at a blank wall, or an uncluttered space in your house. With your eyes open, rest your gaze on a point slightly above your line of sight. Soften your eyes so that they are unfocused and you are also receiving the images on the periphery of your vision. Relax the flesh around your eyes, letting your eyeballs float gently in their sockets. Take a few moments to do a quick scan through your body, releasing any tension, especially in the shoulders, hands, and belly. Now, with a receptive awareness, begin noticing the arising and disappearing of sounds in the space around you. Spend a minute or two simply listening. Be aware of nearby sounds, noticing their beginnings and endings. Notice the spaces between sounds. Become aware of more far-off sounds, then open to the most distant sounds you can detect. Relax and open into awareness that includes even the most distant sounds you detect. Sense how everything you perceive, sights, sounds, tastes, sensations, moods, arises and passes away within boundless awareness. Continue with your eyes open, downcast, or, if you prefer, closed. Let your attention rest softly on the out-breath, letting go into space with each exhale. Follow each breath as it dissolves outward into open space. Feel that your entire body and mind could follow the out-breath and dissolve into space. Sense that your awareness is mingling with endless space, absolutely open, boundless. As the breath comes in, simply rest in openness, listening and awake, doing nothing. Then again, let go outward with the exhale. Inhaling, rest in receptive, spacious awareness. Exhaling, relax into openness. You can meditate with the breath in this way for as long as you like. Now resting in this natural openness, bring to mind a situation that evokes fear. Ask yourself, what is the worst part of this situation? What am I really afraid of? While your inquiry may arouse a story, if you stay alert to the sensations that arise in your body, the story becomes a gateway to accessing your feelings more fully. Paying particular attention to your throat, chest, and stomach area, discover how fear expresses itself in you. You might kindly invite the fear. Be as much as you really are. Now, as you breathe in, let the breath directly touch the place of most pain and vulnerability. Bring your full attention to the sensations of fear. As you breathe out, sense the openness of space that holds your experience. Feel the fear as if floating and untwisting itself in this openness. What does the fear actually feel like? Where in your body do you feel it most strongly? Do the sensations change or move to different parts of your body? What is their shape? What color, if any? How do you experience fear in your mind? Does it feel contracted? Is your mind racing or confused? With each in-breath, feel your willingness to gently connect with the waves of life that are unpleasant and disturbing. Breathing out, let go and feel how the waves of fear belong to a larger world, an ocean of openness. You can surrender your fear into this vast and tender space of healing. Breathing in, You contact the immediate sensations with a kind and clear attention. Breathing out, you realize you're belonging to the boundless awareness that has room for all of life's fears. If you feel defeated or numb, focus on your physical sensations and contact them fully with the in-breath. If you feel as if the fear is too much, emphasize breathing out, letting go into openness and safety. It can help you to begin again by listening to sounds or opening your eyes. You might remember the spaciousness of the world or reflect with compassion on all those who at this moment are also feeling fear. You might bring to mind a person or spiritual figure or place in nature that conveys a sense of safety. Once you feel that you belong to a larger world, again, attend to the way that fear expresses through your body and mind. With time, you will discover an artful balancing of touching fear and remembering openness. You can practice being with fear as it arises any time during the day. Using your breath, allow yourself to touch the sensations of fear, and exhaling, let go into openness. This way, the energy does not get buried and begin to fester. Instead of reinforcing a fearful self who is running from life, you become increasingly confident and feel more fully alive. 8. Awakening compassion for ourselves, becoming the holder and the held. All you need is already within you, only you must approach yourself with reverence and love. Self-condemnation and self-distrust are grievous errors. All I plead with you is this: make love of yourself perfect. Sri Nisargadatta. God created the child, that is your wanting, so that it might cry out, so that milk might come. Cry out, don't be stolid and silent. With your pain, lament, and let the milk of loving flow into you. Rumi. We were 3 days into a week-long meditation retreat when Daniel came in to see me for his first interview. He plopped down in the chair across from me and immediately pronounced himself the most judgmental person in the world. When I meditate, whatever I'm thinking or feeling, I end up finding something wrong with it. During walking practice or eating, I start thinking I should be doing it better, more mindfully. When I'm doing the loving-kindness meditation, my heart feels like a cold stone. When Daniel's back hurt while he was sitting, or when his attention wandered and he got lost in thought, he would rail at himself for being a hopeless meditator. Daniel confessed that he even felt awkward in coming in for an interview, afraid that he would be wasting my time. While others were not exempt from his barrage of hostility, most of it was directed at himself. I know that Buddhist teachings are based on being compassionate, he said bitterly, but it's hard to imagine they'll ever rub off on me. Being hard on ourselves like Daniel is familiar to many of us. We often distance ourselves from emotional pain, our vulnerability, anger, jealousy, fear, by covering it over with self-judgment. When we push away parts of ourselves, we only dig ourselves deeper into the trance of unworthiness. We might clearly perceive the faults and shortcomings of ourselves and others. We might recognize we are judging. We might acknowledge that we are stuck in anger or craving or fear. We might even say we accept what we see. But radical acceptance has two wings, compassion as well as mindfulness. We cannot be accepting of our experience if our heart has hardened in fear and blame. In the two previous chapters, we've seen how a degree of compassion has helped people use the tools of mindfulness skillfully in facing desire or fear. When Sarah, who struggled with a food addiction, remembered, "It's not my fault," and forgave herself, her heart opened and softened in a way that made mindful presence possible. Barbara could not face her fear until she had taken refuge in our therapy relationship and learned to find a container of safety and refuge on her own. While thus far the emphasis has been on using the wing of mindfulness to free ourselves from suffering, in this and the next two chapters, we're going to focus on ways to directly awaken the wing of compassion. If we are trapped in self-judgment, like Daniel, our first and wisest step toward the freedom of radical acceptance is to develop compassion for ourselves. If we've injured someone and are embroiled in guilt and self-recrimination, compassion for ourselves allows us to find a wise and healing way to make amends. If we are drowning in grief or sorrow, arousing compassion helps us remember the love and connection in our life. Rather than pushing them away, we free ourselves by holding our hurting places with the unconditional tenderness of compassion. Compassion means to be with, feel with, suffer with. Classical Buddhist texts describe compassion as the quivering of the heart, a visceral tenderness in the face of suffering. In the Buddhist tradition, one who has realized the fullness of compassion and lives from compassion is called a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva's path and teaching is that when we allow our hearts to be touched by suffering, our own or another's, our natural compassion flowers. The bodhisattva's aspiration is simple and powerful. May all circumstances serve to awaken compassion. When we are going through a divorce, afraid for our child, facing disease, facing death, whatever is happening can be a gateway to the clear and limitless compassion, which is the essence of radical acceptance. My understanding of the bodhisattva path is that we are all awakening beings, each of us learning to face suffering, each of us discovering the compassion that expresses our deepest nature. As we come to trust in suffering as a gateway to compassion, we undo our deepest conditioning to run away from pain. Rather than struggling against life, we are able to embrace our experience and all beings with a full and tender presence. To cultivate the tenderness of compassion, we not only stop running from suffering, we deliberately bring our attention to it. Buddhist compassion practices usually begin with being aware of our own pain, because once our hearts are tender and open to our own suffering, we can more easily extend compassion to others. Sometimes, we most easily connect with tenderness by first focusing our attention on the suffering of others, and then bringing attention to our experience. Either way, as we feel suffering and relate to it with care rather than resistance, we awaken the heart of compassion. As we practice responding to our suffering with the kindness of compassion, our hearts can become, as Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg says, as wide as the world. Holding ourselves with compassion. When I asked Daniel how long he had been turning so harshly on himself, he paused for several moments. He said it had been for as long as he could remember. He had joined his mother in relentlessly badgering himself from an early age, ignoring the hurt in his heart. As an adult, he treated his heart and body with impatience and irritation. Even in the face of a tormenting divorce and a long bout of chronic back pain, Daniel hadn't been able to acknowledge how real and intense his suffering was. Instead, he criticized himself for having screwed up the marriage and for not having the sense to take proper care of himself. I asked Daniel if he could tell me what happened in his body when he was judging himself. He pointed to his chest and said his heart felt bound by tight metal cords. I asked if he could feel that right in this moment. To his surprise, Daniel heard himself saying, "You know, this really hurts." I gently asked him how he felt about the pain in his heart. "Sad," he responded softly, his eyes welling up with tears. It's hard to believe I've been carrying this much pain for so long. I suggested he put his hand on his heart, on the place where he most felt the pain. I asked if he might send a message to the pain. How would it feel for you to say, "I care about this suffering"? Daniel glanced at me and then looked down again. Strange, I think. I encouraged him to try, to just whisper the words softly. As he did so, and then repeated the phrase slowly two more times, Daniel's shoulders began to shake with quiet sobbing. We've all felt the power of someone's care to melt our armor. When we feel upset, often not until someone cares enough to listen or gives us a hug, are we able to melt down and cry. When someone says to us, as Thich Nhat Hanh suggests, "Darling, I care about your suffering," a deep healing begins. We might quite readily offer such care to others, but we can learn to offer the same kind of gentle attention to ourselves. With the tenderness we might bring to stroking the cheek of a sleeping child, we can softly place a hand on our own cheek or heart. We can comfort ourselves with words of kindness and understanding. Offering ourselves such care might feel strange and unfamiliar at first, as it did for Daniel. Sometimes, extending compassion to ourselves in this way feels downright embarrassing. It can trigger a sense of shame about being needy and undeserving, shame about being self-indulgent. But this revolutionary act of treating ourselves tenderly can begin to undo the adverse messages of a lifetime. Over the next few days, whenever Daniel became aware of judging himself or others, he would check into his body to see where he was feeling pain. Usually, he would find his throat, heart, and stomach tightened in fear, and his chest heavy and sore. With a very gentle touch, Daniel would place his hand on his heart and say, "I care about this suffering." Because he was sitting in the front of the meditation hall, I noticed that his hand was almost permanently resting on his heart. One afternoon, Daniel came to tell me about something that had happened earlier that day in meditation. A scene had arisen in his mind of being at his mother's house, engaged in an angry exchange with her. As he tried to explain why it wasn't irresponsible for him to take a week off to meditate, he could hear her disdainful reply, "You lazy bum! Why don't you do something worthwhile with yourself?" This was the same kind of demeaning message that in his youth had made him want to shrivel up and disappear. He felt his chest fill with the heat and pressure of rage. In his mind, he heard himself shouting, "You fucking bitch! You don't understand! You've never understood! Can't you shut up for just a minute and see who I am?" Daniel could feel the pain of anger and frustration like a knife stabbing at his heart. He was just about to launch into a diatribe at himself for being such a wimp, for not standing up to her, and for being a meditator filled with such hatred. Instead, he placed both hands on his heart and whispered over and over, "I care about this suffering. May I be free from suffering." After a few minutes, the stabbing anger had subsided, and in its place he could feel warmth spreading through his chest and a softening and opening around his heart. Feeling as if the vulnerable part of him was listening and taking comfort, Daniel said, "I'm not leaving you. I'm here and I care." Throughout the rest of the retreat, Daniel practiced like this, and some of the painful knots, the wounds of his young, anguished self, slowly began to release. When he came in for his final interview, Daniel's whole countenance was transformed. His edges had softened, his body was relaxed, his eyes bright. In contrast to his former awkwardness and hesitancy with me, Daniel seemed glad to be there. He said that the judgments and self-blame had continued, but not with such unrelenting cruelty. No longer imprisoned by constantly feeling something was wrong with him, he He was beginning to notice the world in new ways. Other students seemed more friendly. The acres of forest were an inviting, magical sanctuary. The Dharma talks stirred up a childlike fascination and wonder about how it all is. He felt energized and somewhat bewildered by the fresh sense of possibility in his life. By holding himself with a compassionate presence, Daniel was becoming free to participate more fully in his world. Because, like Daniel, we become so addicted to judging and mistrusting ourselves, any sincere gesture of care to the wounded places brings about radical transformation. Our suffering becomes a gateway to the compassion that frees our heart. When we become the holder of our own sorrows, our old roles as judge, adversary, or victim are no longer being fueled. In their place, we find not a new role, but a courageous openness and a capacity for genuine tenderness, not only for ourselves, but for others as well. Reaching out for compassion. At a weekend workshop I led on radical acceptance, one of the participants, Marion, shared her story about the shame and guilt that had tortured her. Marion's daughter, Christy, in recovery for alcoholism, had asked her mother to join her in therapy. As their sessions unfolded, Christy revealed that she had been sexually abused throughout her teen years by her stepfather, Marion's second husband. When Marion was asleep or not at home, he'd enter Christy's bedroom and lock the door so that her younger sister wouldn't surprise them. Almost every week he would arrive drunk, demand that she give him oral sex, and then swear her to silence. He told her that if word got out, he'd beat her so badly that she'd wish she'd never been born. He also threatened to start doing the same thing with Christy's little sister. Sometimes he cried, saying that if Christy's mother ever found out, it would destroy her. She'd probably kill herself. With each new revelation from her daughter, Marion felt her soul plunging deeper into a bottomless pit. Her days became a living nightmare. She would relentlessly rerun the mental movie of her husband sneaking into Christy's room and forcing the girl sexually. Rage would overcome her, and she would plot violent acts of vengeance against this man who had harmed her daughter. Only slowly did it dawn on her how much she herself was to blame. Imagining herself clueless, asleep downstairs after perhaps too much wine, Marion felt racked by self-hatred. Her mind fueled her misery with its endless assaults of, "If only I had known," and "How could I be so blind?" Compassion for herself was not only impossible. Marion was convinced it would have been wrong. She was the mother, she told herself. What had happened to Christy was her fault. She deserved to suffer. Then at one session, what Marion had feared all along happened. Christy verbally attacked her. "You just slept through my whole adolescence," she shouted. "I was being violated and had nowhere to turn. No one was there to take care of me." Christy's face was red, and her hands clenched into tight fists. "There, I've done it. I've told you the truth, and now you'll disappear again. I was afraid to tell you then, and now I know why. You can't handle the truth. You can't handle me. You never could. I hate you," screamed Christy. "I hate you. I hate you." Marion felt the words pierce her heart. As she watched Christy dissolve into great heaving sobs, Marion knew what she'd heard was true. She had indeed hidden away from Christy's pain by sleeping. She hadn't been able to handle her daughter's involvement with drugs, her clashes with teachers, her truancy and suspensions from school, because she couldn't handle anything about her own life. Much like her first marriage, her relationship with her second husband had quickly disintegrated after he had an affair. Her way of managing depression was through drinking with her friends and oversleeping. By the time she entered therapy and finally divorced, both her girls had left home. Now she knew how tragically she had failed Christy and her sister. How she had failed in everything that was important. There was no reason to go on living. We have all harmed others and felt as if we were bad because of our actions. For Marion, the unavoidable truth was that she had played a direct role in Christy's suffering. When we, like Marion, face the truth that we have hurt others, sometimes severely, the feelings of guilt can tear us apart. Even when the damage is not so great, some of us still feel undeserving of compassion or redemption. At times like these, the only way to find compassion for ourselves is by reaching out to something larger than the self that feels so small and miserable. We might take refuge by calling on the beloved, on Buddha or the Divine Mother, God or Jesus, the Great Spirit, Shiva or Allah. We reach toward the loving awareness that is great enough to offer comfort and safety to our broken being. As a Catholic, Marianne had found through prayer moments of deep peace and communion with a loving God. But in her despair, she now felt alone in the universe. Sure, God existed, but she felt too sinful and wretched to reach out to him. Thomas Merton writes, "True love and prayer are learned in the hour where prayer has become impossible and the heart has turned to stone." Marianne's hour had come. Fearing she might harm herself, Marion sought counsel from an elderly Jesuit priest who had been one of her teachers in college. Crying, she collapsed in the overstuffed chair he offered. "Please, please help me," she pleaded. He listened to her story and sat quietly with her as she wept. When she calmed down, he gently took one of her hands and began drawing a circle in the center of her palm. "This," he said, "is where you are living. It is painful, a place of kicking and screaming and deep, deep hurt. This place cannot be avoided. Let it be." Then he covered her whole hand with his. "But if you can," he went on, "try also to remember this. There is a greatness, a wholeness that is the kingdom of God. And in this merciful space, your immediate life can unfold. This pain," and he again touched the center of her palm, "is held always in God's love. As you know both the pain and the love, your wounds will heal." Marion felt as if a great wave of compassion was pouring through the hands of the priest and gently bathing her, inviting her to surrender into its caring embrace. As she gave her desperation to it, she knew she was giving herself to the mercy of God. The more she let go, the more she felt held. Yes, she had been blind and ignorant. She had caused irreparable damage. But she wasn't worthless. She wasn't evil. Being held in the infinite compassion of God, she could find her way to her own heart. Feeling compassion for ourselves in no way releases us from responsibility for our actions. Rather, it releases us from the self-hatred that prevents us from responding to our life with clarity and balance. The priest was not advising Marion to ignore the pain or to deny that she had failed her daughter, but to open her heart to the love that could begin the healing. Now, rather than being locked inside her tormenting thoughts, Marion could remember the possibility of compassion. When remorse or self-hatred would arise, she would mentally say, "Please hold this pain." When she felt her anguish as being held by God, she could face it without being ripped apart or wanting to destroy herself. As her mind began to settle and clear, Marion was able to reflect on what she could do, how she could help Christy. 2 weeks later, when they met again in a therapy session, Christy was guarded and cold. Silently, Marion took a seat next to her on the couch. When Christy didn't withdraw, Marion moved a little closer. She told her she knew that she had failed her terribly. I should have been there to protect and comfort you. And instead, I let you down. I was so wrapped up in my own pain that I couldn't see yours. She paused, looking earnestly into her daughter's eyes. I can't tell you how sorry I am. I know I can't make your pain go away, Christy. But I want to be with you as you find yourself. I'm not going to disappear again. Gently taking Christy's hand, Marion told her the story of what had happened with the priest. Drawing a soft circle in the center of her palm, she whispered his words. This place cannot be avoided. Let it be. Then, covering Christy's hand with her own, she went on. But in this merciful space that is the kingdom of God, your life can unfold. By the time they embraced, both were in tears. Holding her sobbing child, Marion felt filled with a tender compassion for both of them. Christy let herself be held, surrendering into the unexpected strength and sureness of her mother's love. There was no way either of them could bypass the raw pain of yet unhealed wounds, but now they could heal together. By reaching out and feeling held in God's mercy, Marion had discovered the compassion that could hold them both. Marion's story stirred up deep feelings in those participating in the workshop on radical acceptance. Many told of their hour where prayer has become impossible times, when they felt too worthless to be loved. As a group, we explored some ways we might reach out at these times to a source of compassion, and through it, learn to hold ourselves. We explored how the wise compassion at the heart of radical acceptance begins with regarding our own being with unconditional care. When we feel separate and alone, we long to be held like a child in the compassionate heart of an all-loving mother, a merciful and accepting father. At these times, we can reach out and offer our brokenness to this healing embrace. As Rilke puts it, I yearn to be held in the great hands of your heart. Oh, let them take me now. Into them I place these fragments, my life. When we feel held by a caring presence, by something larger than our small, frightened self, we begin to find room in our own heart for the fragments of our life and for the lives of others. The suffering that might have seemed too much can awaken us to the sweetness of compassion. Mindful prayer. May this suffering awaken compassion. We might think of Marion's devotional style of praying as peculiar to Christianity and other God-centered religions. Yet no matter what we believe, as human beings we all tend to reach out to something in moments of desperation. We might call out for relief from a migraine, beg to be selected for a job, pray for the wisdom to guide our child through a difficult time. Maybe we whisper, oh please, and feel that we are asking the universe for help. When we feel disconnected and afraid, we long for the comfort and peace that come from belonging to something larger and more powerful. Students of Buddhist practice often wonder if this kind of prayer reinforces the notion of a separate and wanting self. We do seem to be beseeching someone or something greater than our small and frightened self. And who exactly are we praying to? I grew up Unitarian, and I remember how we used to joke about addressing our prayers to whom it may concern. Following the path of the Buddha, we might have the same question. While prayer does suggest a dualism of self and other, it can be a direct path to the non-dual experience of fully belonging. Although not always highlighted in the West, prayer and devotion are a living stream in Buddhism. The earnest wishes expressed in the practices of loving kindness and compassion, may I be happy, may I be free from pain and suffering, are forms of prayer. Our prayers of aspiration and our longing for relief from suffering may not necessarily be directed to anyone or anything, but we might also address them to the Buddha or one of the other great teachers or bodhisattvas we regard as embodiments of the awakened heart and mind. When done with mindfulness and sincerity, this kind of devotional prayer becomes a way to awaken our own heart and mind. When we are suffering and turn to prayer, no matter what the apparent reasons for our pain, the basic cause is always the same. We feel separate and alone. We reach out to be relieved of this pain of isolation. Celtic poet and scholar John O'Donohue, in his book Eternal Echoes, writes, "Prayer is the voice of longing. It reaches outwards and inwards to unearth our ancient belonging." This is a beautiful description of what I call mindful prayer. We reach not just outward to know our belonging, but with mindful prayer we also turn inward and listen deeply to the suffering that is giving rise to our prayer. When we are willing to touch the pain of separation, our longing carries us to the tender and compassionate presence that is our awakened nature. I experienced the transforming power of mindful prayer some years ago when I was suffering from a broken heart. I had fallen in love with a man who lived 2,000 miles away, on the other side of the country. Because we had very different desires about having a family and about where to live, we couldn't weave our lives together, and the relationship ended. The loss was crushing. For many weeks I was swamped in obsessing about him, sobbing, overwhelmed with grief. I stopped listening to the radio because classic rock songs often left me weeping. I avoided romantic movies. I barely talked with friends about him because even saying his name out loud would freshly reopen the wound. I accepted my grieving process for the first month or so, but as it went on and on, I started feeling ashamed of how big and dominating my sense of desolation was. On top of that, I felt that something must be wrong with me for being such an emotional wreck. The man was moving on, dating other people. Why couldn't I do the same? I tried to wake up out of the stories. I tried mindfully letting the pain pass through. But I remained possessed by feelings of longing and loss. I felt more excruciatingly lonely than I had ever felt in my life. In the room where I meditate, I have a Tibetan scroll painting called a Tanka of the Bodhisattva of Compassion. Known as Tara in Tibet and Kuan Yin in China, she is an embodiment of healing and compassion. It is said that Kuan Yin hears the cries of the suffering world and responds with the quivering of her heart. One morning, about a month into my meltdown, as I sat crying in front of the Tanka, I found myself praying to Kuan Yin. Like Marian, I didn't feel any compassion for myself. I felt crushed and worthless. I wanted to be held in Kuan Yin's compassionate embrace. On and off over my years of Buddhist practice, I had prayed to Kuan Yin, primarily relating to her as a symbol of compassion that could help me awaken my own heart. But I hadn't really prayed to her in the way Marian had prayed, reaching out to her as a spiritual presence, as a larger being than my small self. Now, in my desperation, it was different. Kuan Yin was no longer just a symbol of inspiration. She was the beloved, a boundless and loving presence who, I hoped, could help relieve my suffering. For a few days I did find some comfort by reaching out in this way. But one morning I hit a wall. What was I doing? My ongoing ritual of aching and praying and crying and hating my suffering was not really moving me toward healing. Kuan Yin suddenly seemed like an idea I had conjured up to soothe myself. Yet without having her as a refuge, I now had absolutely nowhere to turn, nothing to hold on to, no way out of the empty hole of pain. What felt most excruciating was that the suffering seemed endless and utterly worthless. Even though it seemed like just another concept, I remembered that for the aspiring bodhisattva, suffering is the trusted gateway to awakening the heart. I remembered that when I had remained present with pain in the past, something had indeed changed. Suddenly I realized that maybe this situation was about